On this last Sunday before Lent, when the church prepares to remember the suffering of Jesus and his death, we have this glorious story of the Transfiguration. Lent, we often think of, is rather gloomy and dark. But this is a vision that we ought to keep before us throughout the season. This glimpse of glory, this vision of Christ revealed, if only for a moment. There is purpose in suffering. There is light shining in the darkness. There is life that comes out of death. Now, to be sure, we are not always able to glimpse the wonder and glory of God's presence in every situation of life. But the Transfiguration is a pledge and promise of God to overcome suffering and death, or whatever comes to us in this life. The transfigured appearance of Jesus on the mountain anticipates both his resurrection and his coming again in glory. Maybe one could liken the Transfiguration to a movie preview. In it, we anticipate the full story and the ending. Whenever there is a mountain in the Bible, it is likely that someone is having a close encounter with God. Moses, in our first reading, is up on the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments. Jesus had taught most of the time by the seashore and on the hillsides and in villages, but for the Transfiguration, he takes his three favorite disciples with him up on a mountain. We don't know which mountain it was or how long it took them to climb. They must have been fairly physically fit. But what they experienced on the mountain transformed them as no other teaching. All three synoptic gospels grasp for words that describe the scene. Matthew says that Jesus' face shone like the sun. Mark says that his clothes were brighter than any bleach could make them. And Luke says that his clothes became dazzling white. Transfiguration. It's not a word that we use every day. It means something that changes in appearance or in form. The Greek word used in the text is a word from which we derive the English word metamorphosis, which may conjure up images of caterpillars turning into butterflies, or the ability of the wizards in the Harry Potter stories to change teacups into rats, or something like flowers into candles. But these images don't quite explain what happened to Jesus on that mountaintop. We don't want to say, do we, that Jesus changed from one kind of being into another, completely different? The church has always struggled with this idea that Jesus was one person with two natures, fully human and fully divine. The Nicene Creed, which we sometimes use as our profession of faith, goes into some detail as to how this is. Jesus was true God, begotten, not made, truly divine, but then also for our salvation, came down from heaven, was incarnate of the Holy Spirit and the Virgin Mary, and became truly human. We don't say that Jesus was divine one moment and then changes into a human being. So to avoid this, we say that what happened on the mountaintop is that the divine nature rose in prominence in a way that was not generally seen as Jesus was on earth Or we could say that for a few moments, the Father showed the disciples what Jesus had, as the Son of God, had always been before he emptied himself of certain divine traits so as to become truly human. But we should never say that this was the only time when the divine nature of Jesus was on display in this glory, in this great light. Every day, Jesus revealed the glory of God when he spoke kindly to sinners and forgave them, when he fed the hungry and healed the sick and rebuked the religious leaders for their holier-than-thou attitude. That too was a display of God's love and glory. And could God's glory ever appear more brightly than when the crown of thorns was pressed into his flesh and when he was lifted up on the cross to die? It was a different kind of glory, to be sure, but it gave us a glimpse of God's amazing grace and love. Now, this glory shown on the mountaintop was no surprise to Moses and Elijah who appeared with him. They were already in the nearer presence of God. But Peter, James, and John were completely awestruck and at a loss as to what to say or what to do. And each of them probably responded a bit differently to this glory revealed. Peter, the extrovert and man of action, started talking and suggested that he build three shelters, perhaps some kind of memorial to capture the moment. John, as far as we know, said nothing, but perhaps he was the first to fall to the ground when this bright cloud overshadowed them and they heard the voice that said, "This is my Son, the Beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." John became known for seeing visions on the island of Patmos where he wrote the book of Revelation. He was a mystic. And James? Well, as far as we know, he didn't have anything to say, really. But later we have an epistle attributed to him, the letter of James. Although there were some in the church who didn't think it really belonged in the Bible, it was more about doing good works than having faith. Even Martin Luther called it a book of straw. But James became an important leader in the early church. But maybe at this moment in his life, James was on the mountaintop wondering, "What am I doing here?" I guess at one time or another, we all wonder whether we're doing the right thing or saying the right thing or whether we should even be in the company of religious people at all. If you are the kind of person who, like Peter, tends to speak and act before you think, well, maybe you ought to stop talking. You don't need to do anything in the presence of God but listen. If you're the kind of person who needs time to process everything, like John, don't panic. You don't need to come up with a plan. Just listen. And if you're the kind of person who feels that everyone else has a reason to be here and you got here by accident, like James, well, don't worry. You don't have to explain why you're here in the presence of God. Just listen. Stop. Breathe. Listen. "This is my Son, the Beloved. With him I am well pleased." Listen to him. Maybe this is the purpose of our meditation walk this afternoon. It's not to do anything or say anything or plan anything. It's to listen to the voice of Jesus. What I appreciate about the reaction of the three disciples is that it was very natural and human. The light was blinding. God's glory was overwhelming. And hearing the voice from heaven, they fell to the ground. They were overcome, it says, by fear. Now, we like to think that when we have a experience with God, we should feel excited and happy or have a sense of peace and comfort to know that God is with us. And sometimes I think that is the case. But when we read through the Gospels, fear is often the overwhelming emotion when people realize that God is with them. When Jesus appeared to the disciples after they fished all night and caught nothing and then came up with a net-breaking catch, it says that they were afraid. And when Jesus saved the disciples in a storm by calming the wind and waves, when peace came, they were afraid. And when the women came to the tomb on the first Easter morning and found the tomb empty, they were afraid. In many ways, we live in a time of fear. We fear that the chaos and violence of nations around the world will spill over into our life and into our nation. We fear people coming from other places. We fear people of other races and religions. Much of the fear, of course, is based upon untruths about people we do not know. And on a personal level, we fear illness and failing health and many of the bad things that happen in our lives. The doctor comes in after an exam and says, "I think you might have a problem, but nothing to worry about. We'll take some more tests." But we do worry, and we're afraid. But fear and worry come not only because of untruths about foreigners or our frail human condition. We fear God because God is God. We might say that we want more of God in our lives, but do we really? Pollsters have been telling us for years that many people, even those who don't attend church, are on a spiritual search. But I wonder what people are expecting when they ask that they find God. Maybe they expect a sense of peace. Or maybe they expect God's blessing and prosperity. Or maybe they hope that God will help them win the lottery. But why do these close encounters with God often bring fear? In our Old Testament reading, Moses had gone to meet the Lord on the mountain. And for the people of Israel looking on it, even at a distance, the glory of the Lord looked like a consuming fire. And they were afraid. In the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, the writer tells us that it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. God knows us through and through. God disrupts our lives and changes us, and we are afraid. Sometimes I wonder whether people stay away from church not because they don't like our church music or they don't find us very friendly or they don't understand our theology, but maybe they understand all too well that the church is about God. And it is a fearful thing to be in the presence of the living God. But notice in our text that Jesus doesn't leave his disciples in fear. Here they are, lying face down in the dirt, and Jesus comes and touches them and says, "Get up and do not be afraid." Jesus helped them to deal with their anxiety and take away their fear. First of all, he simply says, "Get up." He gets them to get out of their position of fear and helplessness. Jesus' face is no longer shining like the sun, but he is there to walk with them. Second, Jesus leads the way down the mountain. He doesn't give them much time just to hang around and meditate on this wonderful thing that had happened to them, or to delay coming back into the mainstream of life where they will face all kinds of challenges and difficulties. Of course, they needed some assurance that despite his humble appearance in his daily life, Jesus was the one sent from God, the one that they are called to follow. And then Jesus does something else. He tells his disciples to keep quiet about what they saw. That's a bit of a surprise, don't you think? Don't tell anyone about this. Not right now. At the end of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus again is up on a mountain with his disciples, this time all 11 of them. Judas, of course, is no longer with them. And he tells them to go and make disciples of all nations. Tell everybody. But at this point in his ministry, Jesus wants it to remain a mystery. How he, the Son of God, must suffer and die and be raised from the dead. How could the disciples ever explain that mystery until after it actually happened? So there are things in our lives that cannot be explained. Why does God cause good people to suffer? Why is there so much evil in the world? All that we can do is to trust that God will finally bring us to a place where we can see the light and bear witness to God's goodness and love and tell the whole world. A pastor tells the story of visiting a young patient in the hospital who was being treated for leukemia over many months. During these months, Jan was on an amazing spiritual journey, searching for God, but she was not getting any better physically. Why does a person just 20 years old suffer this dreaded disease? One day when the pastor came to her bedside, Jan was in a panic, calling out that she could not see. The pastor said, "Well, try opening your eyes." She did and said, "Oh, now I see." Then the pastor asked, looking into her eyes, "Well, Jan, what do you see?" And she said, "I see Jesus." Well, the pastor didn't quite know what to say or how to respond. How could she mistake him for Jesus? He doubted that there was any resemblance. Only later did the pastor realize that Jan had a glimpse of another reality. Jan didn't see me as Jesus. He saw Jesus. Like Peter, James, and John, she caught a glimpse of the divine. She saw and understood that Jesus was there, had always been there with her, and would always be there. She had nothing to fear. She was not alone. She knew how everything would turn out in the end. At this point in her life, at her death, Jan was able to see what was most real. She had a glimpse of the glory of God. Maybe we would have liked to have been in the company of the disciples on the mountain and to have seen the face of Jesus shining like the sun. However, perhaps we just need to open our eyes and open our ears to listen to whatever glimpse of glory that God might reveal to us. Whether on a mountaintop, or in daily life, or in a hospital room, or wherever God might choose to come into our lives. For it is God who said, let light shine out of darkness, who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Amen.